When we look at Revelation 17, you'll see in the outline that I didn't resist the title that I should have, called The Beauty and the Beast. When you have her described here in the passage, you'll find that she's none too beautiful, but this is too loud. It seems to be echoing around in my head anyway. She's none too beautiful. That is, she's Babylon, the woman, as she's imaged sitting on a beast. Going to take it section by section today, though. I know we haven't read it yet, but let's look at the first six verses about the mystery of the woman and the beast. One of the seven angels who had the seven bowls came to me and said to me, "Come, I will show you the punishment of the great prostitute who sits on the many waters. With her, the kings of the earth committed adultery, and the inhabitants of the earth were intoxicated with the wine of her adulteries." Then the angel carried me away in the spirit into a desert, and there I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast that was covered with blasphemous names and had seven heads and ten horns. The woman was dressed in purple and scarlet and was glittering with gold, precious stone and pearls. She held a golden cup in her hand, filled with the abominable things and the filth of her adulteries. This title was written on her forehead: Mystery, Babylon the Great, the mother of prostitutes and of the abominations of the earth. I saw that the woman was drunk with the blood of the saints, the blood of those who bore testimony to Jesus. Well, firstly then, the mystery of verses 1 to 6. The angel shows the punishment of the prostitute. She sees the woman in purple and scarlet on a scarlet beast, and the blasphemous names written upon the forehead. The beast has seven horns and seven heads and ten horns. The heads are symbols of authority, and the horns of strength. And so all power, all authority is the beast's. And the woman is a prostitute. That is, her sexuality is an immorality. It's seductive. It's destructive. Thus, she has the luxurious appearance that will seduce. But her cup, the cup that she drinks, the cup is full of abominable things, dreadful, awful things. It's reminiscent back of Jeremiah 51. Babylon was a cup in the Lord's hand, and she made the whole earth drunk. The nations drank her wine, and therefore they have now gone mad. Typical of the way the book of Revelation quotes the Old Testament, it doesn't quote it. It alludes to it. As you read this story here, you should have been, as a biblically literate person, thinking of Jeremiah and 51. It's a great help. We've got cross-references, thanks, John, written in the middle of our Bible so we can chase these things out, isn't it? We should be thinking of a passage like this, but when you look it up every time, you'll find it's just different. Babylon was a gold cup in the Lord's hand. This is the woman who's got the gold cup in her hand, and she is Babylon. And she made the whole earth drunk, so it puts it into the feminine. Drunk, and the nations drank her wine. Well, it's about the nations. All the nations or inhabitants of the earth were intoxicated with the wine of her adulteries and have now gone mad. The drunkenness that is here, though, is a drunkenness, verse 6, of the blood of the saints, the blood of those who've borne testimony to Jesus. And the title that is given to her is Babylon, the mystery, the mother of prostitutes, the abominations of the earth. Now, verses 7 to 18 of the chapter explain the mystery, though when I finish reading it, I suspect you won't have it explained to you, because the word mystery is really a word which means secret. We tend to use the word mystery in English to mean mysterious. And how you find out something that's mysterious is by investigation, is by pondering, is by pursuing the information. Whereas how you find out a secret is somebody tells it to you. And all the pondering in the world will not help you. So if I ask you, what is the mystery, what is the secret of my elder brother's middle name, you can sit and ponder all you like. You can dream dreams and have all kinds of fantasies, but you won't come up with the knowledge. If you've been told what it is, well, then you will know. And you can tell others because you know the secret. Well, the verb here in verse 7 is not explained. It's tell. I will tell you the mystery. I'll tell you the secret would be an easier way of translating it, because it still sounds pretty mysterious when you come to the end of the chapter. So what is it? Well, verses 7 and 8 explain, tell us, of the beast. When I saw her, I was greatly astonished. Then the angel said to me, "Why are you astonished? I will explain to you the mystery. I will tell you the secret of the woman and the beast she rides, which has the 7 heads and the 10 horns. The beast which you saw once was, now is not, and will come up out of the abyss and go to his destructions. The inhabitants of the earth, whose names have not been written in the book of the life from the creation of the world, will be astonished when they see the beast, because he once was, now is not, and yet will come. This beast comes and goes and is to come again, but only to be destroyed. The non-Christian world, those who aren't written in the book of life, the non-Christian world are all amazed at this beast because of this beast's capacity to come and go and come again. We've already seen this back in chapter 13. Whether it's exactly the same beast or not, I do not know. But back in chapter 13, 1 verse 3, one of the heads of the beasts seemed to have a fatal wound, but the fatal wound had been healed, and the whole world was astonished and followed the beast. Well, of course it's astonishing, because the nature of a fatal wound is that you cannot be healed. A healed fatal wound is a contradiction, isn't it? But that's what this beast is. You've killed it, and lo and behold, it's there again. And so you don't seem to be able to kill this beast. And so this beast was, is not, is again, though it is coming to destruction. And so it amazes the world. Verses 9 to 11 warns us of the need for wisdom. This calls for a mind with wisdom. The 7 heads are 7 hills on which the woman sits. They are also 7 kings. 5 have fallen, 1 is, the other has not yet come. But when he does come, he must remain for a little while. The beast, who once was not, and now is not, is an 8th king. He belongs to the 7 and is going to his destruction. Well, the heads are 7 hills, but they're also 7 kings. We'll talk more about identity and equivalence in a little while, but they are 7 hills, they are 7 kings. 5 of them have already fallen, that is, the kings, not the hills. 1 now is, the 6th, 1's yet to come. And then we find that the beast itself is an 8th king, yet it is one of the 7, and the beast itself is going to destruction. Verses 12 to 14 tells us about the 10 horns. The 10 horns you saw are 10 kings who have not yet received a kingdom, but who for 1 hour will receive authority as kings along with the beast. They have one purpose and will give their power and authority to the beast. They will make war against the Lamb, but the Lamb will overcome them because he is Lord of Lords and King of Kings, and with him will be his called, chosen, and faithful followers. Well, there's 10 more kings. They're not yet, but they are coming. They are coming with the beast. But they're only coming for 1 hour reigns. Whether it's 10 sequentially or 10 all at the time, I can't quite work it out. But they come for a limited reign because they've only got one purpose, that is to oppose the Lamb. But their opposition to the Lamb, together with the beast, will not win, because the Lamb is the King of Kings and Lord of Lords, and so he and his people will stand safe and secure and victorious over them. Then verses 15 to 18, I suspect, is a climax that is quite different to your expectations. I may do you an injustice in that regard, but I think it's a twist. 15, then the angel said to me, "The waters you saw, where the prostitute sits, are peoples, multitudes, nations, and languages. The beast and the 10 horns you saw will hate the prostitute. They will bring her to ruin and leave her naked. They will eat her flesh and burn her with fire. For God has put it into their hearts to accomplish his purpose by agreeing to give the beast their power to rule until God's words are fulfilled. The woman you saw is the great city and rules over the kings of the earth." That is, the waters are the nations, the peoples, all under the control of the woman and under the control of the beasts. But the beasts and the horns are actually going to rise up and destroy the woman, which is the surprise I suspect you would not have written. that there is this kind of civil war against her. She seduces them into her adulteries, and yet when the time comes, they will destroy her. And furthermore, to the surprise of many readers, they will destroy her because God puts it into their hearts to destroy her. Verse 17, God has put it into their hearts, that is the hearts of the beast and the ten horns, to accomplish his purpose by agreeing to give the beast their power to rule, that is, give it to the, therefore the there's got to be the peoples. They've given to the beast the power to rule, and the beast is going to rule by destroying the woman who has seduced them all. And so the destruction of this Babylon is coming, the great city, the woman, mystery, Babylon the Great, is coming. Well, what is it all about? Let me just kind of summarise the reading we've done so far. The woman equals Babylon, and the beast has seven heads, which are equal to the seven kings, which are on the beasts, which is the eighth king. But the beast also has ten horns, which are ten more kings, and they're all on the waters, which are the peoples. But the waters are giving to the beast the power to overthrow the woman and destroy her. So Babylon is to be destroyed. But what's Babylon about? And why is it to be destroyed? And what are its seductions and adulteries and prostitutions? And why are we talking about Babylon? Well, let's start off with the history of the name Babylon itself. For Babylon is a very old civilization, one of the oldest that we have, really. It's is that as clear as we're going to get it or not? I don't know. No? Better? On the Euphrates River, it is Babel. It is the plain of Shinar, where the Tower of Babel was built in Genesis 11. And we know of continuous, in digging up Babylon, we know of continuous civilization there as a city from about the 2300 BC mark through to 600 BC. It was a city of some significance and importance. In Genesis 11, when it is the Tower of Babel, the word Babel means gates to heaven, or the gates of the gods. And that's what the tower was about, if you remember. The people were all gathering themselves together on a common cause in order to make a name for humanity by building a tower that would invade heaven. So they were going to establish themselves as the rulers of heaven and earth by building this tower together. And God comes and frustrates humanity's desire to conquer heaven by their civilization. And he frustrates them by giving them different languages, and so dividing humanity so that we cannot work together in harmony to achieve what we are setting out to do. While it was a significant city down the many centuries, it was around 626 that a new dynasty came to power in Babylon. And with this new dynasty, instead of it just being a wealthy city, it became the world ruler for a short period of time. It was a city built on canals like Venice or one of those Italian cities where, or like Florence. It was cities of enormous trading wealth, importance and value to the whole of society, but it was also a force, a political, militaristic force, and it spread across the Middle East and conquered everything, destroyed the Assyrian Empire, but then came across to destroy Judah as well. From 626 to 539, it was the great power of the world. And then it was destroyed almost overnight. And its sudden fall and destruction was always an astonishment to the ancient world. It was a little bit like the Russian Empire of this century. Russia was a nowhere place, really. 1917, the revolution took place, and then it changed. It changed dramatically. It grew in wealth and importance and threat to all the world. It spread its influence across the world, and place after place seemed to fall to its Marxist ideology. As the peoples of Russia seemed to grow in their technological skills and abilities, they were the first one into space, not the Americans. That was a terrible shock to the system. They were winning as many gold medals as the Americans were at the Olympics each time. It was a great shock to the system. They were growing in military power, in naval power, in air force power, in nuclear power. They had everything going for them. But it was unimaginable in the 1950s and 1960s that in a period of something like 2 or 3 years at the end of the 1980s, the whole of the Russian Empire would implode, that the USSR would just kind of collapse into bankruptcy. Was frankly unimaginable. But it happened. Just as from 1917 to, what was it, 1990, it was one of the major powers, if not the major power of the world. Today, well, it's still on the scene, but relatively unimportant, terribly enfeebled. Well, Babylon was like that. For 70 years or so, it suddenly burst into world domination. And then overnight, it collapsed. But its imperial period is so important to the Bible because it was related directly to Judah. When Babylon was powerful, Judah was weak. Just as when Judah was powerful, Babylon was fairly weak. Because Babylon was used by God to judge and to destroy Judah, to capture its peoples, to destroy its temple, and to destroy its city under King Nebuchadnezzar. After 70 years, when Babylon fell, the people of Israel, the people of Judah, were sent back home to rebuild the city and to rebuild the temple. But that was an unbelievable escape for them. They really thought that the end had come. The Assyrians had conquered the northern kingdom of Israel. The two southern states of Judah and Benjamin that formed the new nation of Judah were very small and weak, just gathered around this magnificent temple in this great city. It had been destroyed. 70 years in slavery, it looked like Judah had come to an end. But then Babylon fell, and the people to whom it fell sent the Jews home with money to rebuild their city, to rebuild their temple. The sudden, swift, unexpected, and total destruction of Babylon made Babylon itself a symbol of the judgment of God. It's a symbol of the judgment of God on his enemies, because it was the judgment of God on the enemies inside Judah, but it was also a symbol of pagan civilization overreaching itself, blasphemous in its intentions. For Babylon was proud and arrogant. Babylon vaunted itself. Babylon boasted that the God of Judah was weak and puny, for look what happened to the people of Judah. Babylon overreached itself. And so the judgment of God was symbolized in the destruction of this overreaching nation. And the New Age, it becomes a symbol of the New Age. For it's a symbol of the starting again of God's people back in God's land, around God's temple, in God's city. It was a symbol of that as well. The communist state was like that. When one of their early cosmonauts went up, one of the first men into space, he made some comment, the words of which I cannot remember now, but he made some comment to the effect that he'd looked around and there was no God up here after all. It was that capacity of atheism, in its technological proficiencies, in its technological advances, to be able to scorn the people of God. Babylon was just like that. The Hanging Gardens of Babylon were one of the seven ancient wonders of the world. Nebuchadnezzar set himself up as the god to be worshipped. And remember the stories of Daniel, how over and again Nebuchadnezzar is cut down to size because Nebuchadnezzar sees himself as the ruler of the universe. And in one sense, with good reason, because at the time he ruled the universe. But by God's permission and direction, not by his, even though he didn't know it. So Babylon features large in the prophecies of the Old Testament. Here's a list of a few of them. In Isaiah, in Jeremiah, in Daniel, in Ezekiel, you'll find the city of Babylon is given particular prominence. So all of Isaiah 47 is about it. But just listen to these couple of verses from it and you'll see how similar the Revelation book is on this kind of thing. Isaiah 47, and I pick up verse 8. Now listen, you wanton creature lounging in your security and saying to yourself, I am, and there is none besides me. See, Babylon portrayed as a woman, lounging in her affluence and saying the thing which is God's claim, I am, and there is no other beside me. She goes on, I will never be a widow or suffer the loss of children. Both of these, says God, both of these will overtake you in a moment on a single day, loss of children and widowhood. They will come upon you in full measure in spite of your many sorceries and all your potent spells. You have trusted in your wickedness and have said, no one sees me. Your wisdom and knowledge mislead you when you say to yourself, I am and there is no one beside me. Disaster will come upon you and you will not know how to conjure it away. A calamity will fall upon you that you cannot ward off with a ransom. A catastrophe you cannot foresee will suddenly come upon you. It's typical of the imagery used about Babylon in the prophets of the Old Testament. And Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, Daniel are about this Babylonian captivity, the conquest of people of God by the pagan city, but then the conquest of the pagan city by God, because the pagan city doesn't understand where true power lies. So Babylon's godless, arrogant civilization, wherever you may see it, I'd suggest to you, wealth, power, pleasure, might, splendour, sneeringly blasphemous about God because the defeat of God's people, but a power that will come, astonishingly come, to sudden destruction. You can see it in the Russian event, but you can see it in Britain. You can see it in Australia. You can see it on Wall Street. You can see it with the League of Nations. You can see it in all kinds of places. And you can see it again, you see, on Wall Street. The kind of aggressive, assertive, arrogant power that is exercised at the moment in Wall Street across the world is just like 1920s, which collapsed, plunging people into ruin and misery and into poverty for a decade. It all happened overnight. Because of Keynesian economics, I was taught when I was in school in the 1950s that it could never happen again. We now knew how to control it. We understand them. We now got the mechanics right. Well, of course, it has happened again several times, and we don't live in a Keynesian world anymore. We now live in a post-Keynesian world because Keynes didn't get it right. But there is still that sense that you can invest. Invest and make money and make more money. Indeed, you don't need the market anymore. We've got the net. We can trade in our shares on the net. Although what we're trading in, who knows? Whether the things actually exist, who knows? But people are making huge money and they don't need God when they make huge money. They do not need anything, for they are in power. Civilization has that kind of arrogance about it. And that track record of destruction. But it also keeps coming back. More of that in a moment. So what about Revelation 17? We're going to look at all the time how we're reading, how we're interpreting this part of the Bible. We've already started by referring to Babylon and saying, okay, here is a clear Old Testament symbol, Babylon. What does the Old Testament use Babylon to symbolise? Is that what is being symbolised here? I think so. But there are a couple of other key terms that I need to draw your attention to. Wisdom and mystery are two words that are used here. Wisdom in verse 9. Remember, the Bible teaches that the beginning of wisdom is the fear of the Lord. That is, wisdom is more than intelligence. It's more than cleverness. It's more than education. It's got to do with a right relationship with God. It's got to do with the right basic premise upon which you build your understanding of the world. The right basic premise that you're not God, but God is. And God is sufficiently godlike for you to be afraid of him. Until you get your perspective right about God, then whatever other kind of view of life you have will be distorted. God and the fear of the Lord is necessary to understand Babylon. If you don't fear God, you won't understand Babylon. You won't understand its rise. You won't understand its fall. You won't understand the power of God to judge and condemn wickedness. You won't understand what he's talking about. You need to fear God to understand. And mystery, which occurs in verse 5 and verse 7 on her forehead and in the explanation, it's not the mysterious puzzle, but the secret. what you cannot know unless it has been revealed to you, but what you can know once it has been revealed to you. And so you need to be in fear of God and listen to his revelation if you want to understand. If you try and be clever and nut it out for yourself, you won't. But if you are humble and fearful of God, you will listen to what he has to say, and then you will know. Again, it is part of the arrogance of civilization that we can nut out anything ourselves if we want to, can't we? That's the end of that book by Stephen Hawking on the short history of time, when, you know, if we just make this one more discovery, then we'll know the mind of God, because we will be God, in fact, and it's a nonsense, really. You cannot come to understand the mind of God except God tells you what is on his mind, any more than you can come to understand what's on my mind by your analysis, by your thoughts, by your working out. You can investigate all you like. You'll never know what's on my mind unless I tell you. And once I tell you, you'll say, there wasn't much on his mind after all. No wonder I couldn't find too much there. It was looking for a pea in an ocean. But once I've told you, you know. It's given to you. That is the character of secrets. That is the character of understanding. The method is not intellectual speculation, but obedient listening. Next issue I want to raise with you is the difference between identity and equivalence. That is, identity means the same as, whereas equivalence means the same value, of equal value. Now, those two things are very similar to each other, but subtly different. That is, you see there in chapter 17, verse 9, the seven heads are the seven hills on which the woman sits. They are also seven kings. We're not talking about identity, the same as. We're talking about equivalence. They equate to. That is, 2 + 3 = 5. That's equivalence. 2 and 3 is equivalent to 5. But it's not identity. Identity is 5 = 5. That's both equivalence and identity. You see, 4 + 1 = 5. 4 + 1 is not the same as 2 + 3. It's not the same as 5. They're equivalent, but they're not the same. And so I can say 5 = 4 + 1. 5 = 2 + 3. So I can say the seven hills are equivalent to the woman. It's equivalent to the seven kings. I can say they're equivalent to the seven hills. The seven, what is it we're going on? Seven heads. I can say they're equivalent, but they're not the same as. Now, this confusion between identity and equivalence keeps confusing people in their reading, especially in the book of Revelation, because they want to keep on saying this is identical to that, and then excluding the possibility that it could be equivalent to a lot of other things as well. So they go looking to find the identity of each of the beasts and each of the horns in an attempt to remove any alternative or additional understanding. And so in identifying the symbols, what we're really trying to do is to find the equivalence. The dragon equals Canberra. It's not to be identified as Canberra, as if it's not Washington, it's not Moscow, it's only Canberra, but it is Canberra. It is the University of New South Wales. It is civilization in its arrogance, wherever it may be. It is the rulers and conquerors of the world, wherever they may be. And so to turn chapter 7 into equivalence, well, what do you do with the seven hills? We all, I take it, know that Rome was built on seven hills. Is he talking about Rome? Well, the answer is yes. Is he talking only about Rome? The answer is no. Rome is a prime example, the example of his generation, of a Babylon. And indeed, the reference to the seven hills may be a pointer to Rome, to help you think, say, there's an example of it out there, Rome. Babylon, it would seem, so it's not certain, but it would seem, was a code word for Rome used by the Jews and the Christians at this time. But it's not Rome, it's seven kings. But then you say, well, the seven emperors, because they don't have kings there, they have emperors. And then you start counting them up to try and work out where they are. And the sixth one is Flavian, the seventh one Domitian, because that means the eighth one is Nero, because Nero returns. There's a great myth of Nero's return to life. Nero was a kind of Elvis Presley character of the first century. He was constantly coming back to life. And so he was the one who was, is not, and yet comes again in order to go to his destruction. The only trouble with that kind of numbering system of identifying the emperors is that it depends where you start counting as to which number you give to which of them. You can count the emperors quite differently. There were more than actually eight emperors, and it just depends where you want to start counting emperors as to where you wind up with which number. There's no way you can tack down an identity of anything here, but there is much equivalence to all these things. Let me show you another example. Come across to chapter 21 there for a moment and look at the bride of Christ. We know the bride of Christ is the church. And here it speaks in chapter 21, verse 9. One of the seven angels who had the seven bowls full of the seven last plagues came and said to me, come, I will show you the bride, the wife of the Lamb. And he carried me away in the spirit to a mountain great and high and showed me the holy city, Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God. See, the bride is the church. The bride is also the city. It's not a matter of identity, it's a matter of equivalence. The gathering of the people of God where Christ dwells is the bride where Christ dwells. Both are who they are because of their husband, because of the one who dwells within them. And so it's the same thing, though it seems to be different. All right. What do we have here then? Seven heads, seven hills, seven kings. They're all power, all might. The beast and the woman are like the two beasts back in chapter 13, though they're different. The timing, well, in chapter 14, Babylon falls. In chapter 16, she falls. Chapter 17, it falls. Chapter 18, it's still standing, waiting to fall. The fall of Babylon is what is important, not the sequence, not the timing. This is the moment. It's the fact that it falls so suddenly, so unexpectedly, so totally, so manifestly under the judgment of God. So what is the beauty in the beast? Well, 17:3, he's in the spirit. That is, from the worlds to come's point of view, which now is and you can see, he is going to look and see. And what does he see? Eight characteristics that we go through fairly quickly. Don't panic. Like chapter 13, it's about world government, power, prosperity. And that is why I want to say it's about first century Rome, 19th century Britain, 20th century America. It's about us. It's beckoning and seductive values of materialism, of might and of splendour, of wealth, of power, injustice, of decadence and corruption that is all beckoning you individually right now. For in coming to university, you have put your feet onto the escalator that takes you to exactly that kind of power and prosperity. I know that's not why you came consciously. No, I don't know that. Some of you have come consciously for that reason. Many people don't. It's just the next thing you do. You finish school, I've got to do something. I don't want to work, so university. And mum and dad want me to go there, and that's as good a reason as any other that I can think of, because, say, it's got good holiday arrangements. But yet it is the escalator to power and prosperity, and with it, materialism and seduction into corruption is normal. Abbie Hoffman said, never trust anyone over 30. When he was over 30, people asked him about it. He said, I told you not to trust me. People all sell out when they get over 30. Why do they sell out? Why is it that revolutions happen on university campuses? Well, it's because there is a group of people who for just a little while have an extended childhood where they do not get into the corruption, where they can see clearly how the course of the community is actually hostile to humanity and to values and to virtues. But it doesn't take you long in the workforce when you will start to get the taste for the good things that the world offers you, for the quality of clothing, for the speed of travel, for the toys that you can have, and you get locked in to the overdraft and the career path, the kind of projections for your future development. And before long, the compromises, the fast deals, the shady deals, the questionable ethics, it doesn't take very long A decade is quite long enough to corrupt most graduates so that they become totally indebted to a system that is completely corrupt, which in their youth they could see, but in their middle age they are part of. It is a normal process of a decadent civilization. And the world does it to you intentionally. Some years ago there were some geology students here who were flown down to Melbourne for interviews with one of the big oil companies. At the same time, we met up with some Christians who are geology students who had been flown up by the same oil company from Melbourne to Sydney to be interviewed for the same set of jobs. One of the Christians there came to the church and I met up with them and talked to them. I said, that's funny, one of our friends is down in Melbourne. And so you start tracing out why they fly the Sydney ones to Melbourne and the Melbourne ones to Sydney, so as to put them up in five-star hotels. Why do they put them up in so five-star hotels? So as to seduce them into the beginning of working for the oil company, for the multinational. Right from the beginning, you're showing the high life. I mean, there was no reason they couldn't have interviewed them in their own city. It would have been a lot cheaper. No reason for them to live away from home. They just had interviews during the day, but it was more than they were entertained. They were wined and dined and made to feel very important. Because, you see, in next to no time, they're going to be shoved out of their homes. They're going to be sent overseas. Oh, overseas sounds very attractive when you're just applying for jobs. Yes, you can have a year here, a year there, all the high spots that you're going to live in, the wonderful cities you're going to be in. Why do they want to do that? They don't need to send you overseas. They're sending people from overseas here at the same time. Why are they doing this? So as to break all your linkages with your family and your home and your culture so that you'll become a company person, so that your primary commitment will be to them, that they will own you. They pay all this money. In their budget, it's next to nothing. But they own you, body and soul. They do it intentionally and purposefully. And they're very good at doing it. Very good. Power, prosperity is part of the beauty and the beast that you are being attracted to. The heart of it, though, is rebellion, because the heart of it is mankind without God, aggrandizing himself and ruling the world without God. And therefore, blasphemy and abominable things are written all over it, verse 3. Immorality is part of it, verse 2. Persecution of those who care to stand for truth and who reject their materialistic goals, who stand and oppose them and call upon them to act honestly and with integrity. That is part of it. It's like these big mining companies. They find these little people who have suffered asbestosis as a result of mining. What do we do? Well, we have court cases. And what do we do in the court cases? We use every delaying tactic that is possible, because if the person dies before the court case comes to its judgment, there'll be no judgment against the company. And for 10 or 15 years, the big mining firms just delayed. And you know how they delayed? Because they had young graduates who were lawyers who were willing for a price to delay justice long enough for people to die rather than ever be paid. Young graduates, just a few years older than you, who would sit in universities like you and your colleagues, totally corrupted. You see, godlessness leads to persecution and immorality and all forms of abominable behaviour. Yet it's an image which is astonishing, especially in its capacity to keep reinventing itself. Look at Japan. Look at Germany. Look at Japan and Germany. Totally wiped out at the end of the Second World War. And yet the astonishing capacity to reinvent it themselves by the 1960s, so that by the 70s and 80s they are the economic motor. They are threatening even America itself and Wall Street itself with the power of their own currencies. The world is captivated by the power of the markets to reinvent themselves, to recover, to develop control. Even John himself is amazed in verse 6, though in a moment I'll show you why. But notice also it's limited, because God was and is and will be, but the Babylon was, is not. Will be, but will perish. God is eternal and permanent. The kingdoms of this world come and go. They're limited. In fact, verse 10, you'll see they come and go and rule only for 1 hour, because all is actually under God's control, verse 17. Even when they're railing against God, they're doing his will. No one railed against God more than Nebuchadnezzar, but Nebuchadnezzar was doing God's will. In fact, if you look carefully, you'll see that they are already defeated. Five are down, two more to come, then the last one. And they'll go to destruction. Because when they war against the Lamb, they're doomed, because the Lamb is the King of Kings and Lord of Lords. And so it is self-destructive, verse 16. The beast against the woman, and remember, the house divided against itself is doomed to fail, and Satan is doomed to fall because he is in the end self-destructive. And so Babylon is being shown to us in chapter 17 as punished. That's why John is, in a sense, amazed, because Babylon seems to be all-powerful, and yet it is being punished. It's hard to believe in the 50s and 60s that Russia is going to collapse in the 80s and 90s. It is hard to believe. It is unimaginable to believe that by this time next century, America will be a has-been power. You can't really credit that as a possibility, can you? But why not? This time last century, it was impossible to imagine that Britain would be a has-been power. But they can't even win Wimbledon. Can't even win cricket. Can't even win lawn bowls. I mean, it's a has-been. But 100 years ago? Unimaginable, when Victoria sat upon the world, ruling it. But Babylon was always going to collapse, because Babylon was under God. Even in its self-destruction in verse 17, it was under God, because God's book was written from the beginning of creation, verse 8, and Babylon citizens are not listed in the book of God. It's the citizens of Jerusalem who are listed in the book of God, written from the creation of the worlds. And so chapter 17, verse 3, is the true perception. Being in the Spirit gives you that true perception, because Jesus, raised from the dead, has poured out his Spirit. And no one knows the mind of a man except the Spirit of that man. No one knows the mind of God except the Spirit of God, and those to whom the Spirit speaks. And we have the Spirit of God, we who fear God. And so we have the wisdom, verse 9, the wisdom to know the mystery. Therefore, we will not be astonished as the way the world is astonished. But those who are outside are always astonished by the world, astonished by themselves, astonished by their own cleverness, for they are deceived and deceiving. Do not, my friends, ever be impressed by the power of civilization, especially by the power of civilization to reinvent itself. For civilization set against God is barbarous and will always persecute godliness. And because civilization, even though powerful, will not ultimately win. But those who are described there in chapter 17, verse 14, they're on the winner's side, those who are called chosen, called and faithful followers of the Lamb, because the Lamb is the Lord of Lords and King of Kings. Let's pray. Heavenly Father, we thank you for the victory that is ours in Christ Jesus. We do pray, Father, for the civilization we live in at the moment that is so powerful, so wealthy, so able, and so godless. We do pray, Father, that you would help us to speak to it, to bring many people here into the knowledge of yourself, that they might live in the true kingdom that lasts forever, the one that requires the wisdom of fearing you to ever see. Please send your Spirit upon our colleagues, our contemporaries, our fellow citizens, our fellow students, that they might come to know the Lamb, who is the King of Kings and Lord of Lords, and in whose name we come and approach you in prayer. Amen.